Progress has been slow on a heritage protection alliance, and the New Zealand government looks at repealing cultural protections for Maori children and young people. Hello, I'm Harrison Peterson with the latest from NIRS News. At the Gama Festival over the weekend, the Prime Minister spoke of a partnership with the First Nations Heritage Protection Alliance that will improve connections between traditional owners and businesses. What he was referring to, the work that has been done to modernise Aboriginal heritage laws. 3 years ago, after the destruction of the Juukan Gorge rock caves in Western Australia, the government and the Heritage Protection Alliance partnered up to address gaps in protection for Indigenous sacred sites and country. Chief Executive of the National Native Title Tribunal, Jamie Lowe, says progress has been slow, but there is hope it will come together soon.
Listen, it's been a bit slow. I think everyone would recognise that. All parties think it's been a bit slow, but I think the importance of it, of getting it right is the most important part to it. And there's been some frustration, of course, from community and, you know, even government side and other politicians have set the frustration of it. But our focus has been getting it right. You know, we're still optimistic that that will happen sooner rather than later. Like, we're not going to wait another 3 years, that's for sure. So hopefully within the next, you know, however many months, we can get something that's significant on the table.
A Maori academic says the New Zealand government's decision to repeal a section from the Ministry of Children will strip Maori children and young people from their culture.
So this is about taking children off their families, denying who they are as Indigenous people, forcing them to assimilate, and then the damage that is done by that is irreversible.
That's Maori Professor Margaret Mutu from Auckland University. The Luxon government's looking at repealing Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamarakiri Act, which places importance on the ministry to respect Maori children and young people's connection to culture and family. In response, iwi have been gathering and setting up their own representative body, separate from Aotearoa's Commonwealth government. There'll be more after this.
The skills you bring will help us find better ways, and your ideas will help us shape a future we can all be proud of. We all bring something different. Grow with us. riotinto.com/careers.
Program sponsor.
Australians are being warned not to travel to Bangladesh following protests and the sudden resignation of the country's Prime Minister. In a social media post, Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong says the warnings come because of the extremely volatile security situation and is advising Australians in the country to stay away from large gatherings, keep across local media, and follow the advice of local authorities. And Hamas has named Yahya Sinwar as its new leader, following the assassination of its former leader in Iran last month. Sinwar was one of the architects behind the October 7 terrorist attack on an Israeli music festival, which escalated the conflict in Gaza. Following the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, he became the most powerful Hamas leader alive. And Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's newly announced running mate, has thrown down the gauntlet on his Republican counterpart, J.D. Vance.
Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I gotta tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy.
Mr. Walz has served as Minnesota governor since 2018. Before that, he spent 12 years in the U.S. Congress, was a school teacher and American football coach, and served in the Army National Guard. And moving to sport, and the Boomers have lost to Serbia 90-95 in the basketball quarterfinals at the Paris Olympics. It means the team is now out of medal contention. Patty Mills was the leading point scorer, shooting 26 points. And that is the latest from NIRS News. This up-to-date, you can follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, or visit our website at nirs.org.au.
The National Indigenous Radio Service, the voices of our people.
There's a simple private and free test you can do to detect early signs of bowel cancer. If you're over 50, you should receive a screening kit in the mail every 2 years. You can also order a kit online or talk with your health worker. It's important to do the test as soon as you can. Too many of our mob are getting sick from bowel cancer. That's why I did the test and encouraged my community to do it too. If found early, almost all bowel cancers can be treated. Screening for bowel cancer can help you stay strong and healthy for yourself, your family, and community. For more information, have a yarn with your health worker or visit IndigenousBowelScreen.com.au.
Station sponsor.
Testing for bowel cancer is simple, private, and free. Your free kit is available every 2 years from age 45 to 74. If found early, 90% of bowel cancers can be successfully treated. Doing your bowel cancer screening test every 2 years can help you stay strong and healthy for yourself, your family, and your community. For more information, have a yarn with your health professional or visit IndigenousBowelScreen.com.au.
Station sponsor.
Hey, Bill and Gunnar, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today, and it's been a long time between drinks, let's say, and been on the road, but back to normal broadcasting programming and scheduling here on the Yidinji Territory. And joining me today is Gunyara of Yalmambara, the Attorney General for the Sovereign Yidinji Government. And it's been an action-packed week because of Garama and a lot of the things that have been said there. It's been quite an interesting time because it was the first time, in the Prime Minister's own words, that they had a chance to meet together after the failed referendum, the Voice to Parliament. Actually, let's take a listen to him talking with David Spears from the Insiders program of the ABC.
Prime Minister, thanks for joining us here once again at this very special site.
It's a pretty wonderful part of Australia, isn't it?
It certainly is. Look, after that referendum defeat, you wanted to listen and consult. Some of those here reckon that's turned into a long, deafening silence. So what is your plan now for Indigenous Australians?
Well, the reception that we've had here has been really positive, and the theme here at Garma, underneath the lectern, says fire, strength, renewal. Out of the fire that was lit at Uluru in 2017, it wasn't successful. So we haven't come here to go through the ashes, if you like. After a fire, comes rain and comes new shoots, renewal. And that is one of the themes of this. It was a theme of Jawa's speech here. The leader of the Yolngu people. And it was about economic empowerment was the theme of my speech. How do we close the gap? How do we empower First Nations people so that they get the opportunities that other Australians have? And we see the changes in the global economy, the changes in what Australia's doing, which is heading to the north, whether it be defence and security investment, the investment in critical minerals, the investment in renewable energy, as all presenting an opportunity to go forward.
And I want to come to some of that, but it does sound like you're still searching for the right pathway forward after the referendum. How do you go about that process? Who do you consult? How long does this take?
Well, we've been consulting, and of course there are existing bodies like the Coalition of Peaks that we're continuing to work with on those objectives.
Is that your main source of
advice? Led by Pat Turner. No, our doors are open to all sources of advice. And one of the great privileges of coming here is that this is a forum that is about a celebration of culture, but it's also about a celebration of knowledge and the wisdom that comes from 60,000 years of care for this land and country.
You did say on election night that you were committed to the Uluru Statement in full. That's voice, truth-telling and treaty. I do think it's important to clear this up after the referendum defeat. Where does that commitment now stand?
Well, it hasn't changed in terms of treaty as being negotiated through states and territories. That's at different stages, and that is appropriate given that there are different views and it is not one homogenous grouping around the country.
So no national treaties.
That takes, well, that hasn't changed since the referendum. We weren't progressing a national treaty before the referendum. What was occurring was that states and territories were acting on that. And with regard to Makarrata, a Yolngu word, that simply means a coming together after struggle. I'm somewhat perplexed at why people see that as being complex. Obviously, there has been a struggle for First Nations people. That's why we talk about closing the gap, or what is really a chasm in some areas. And coming together is a principle of walking together, that engagement. It's not a moment in time. It's a process of coming together after struggle.
So what does that process look like? Because talking to people here, it might mean different things to what you're suggesting. What do you actually mean by this?
What it means process? This is happening. This is a coming together of people through engagement. The forums that are held, different bodies, including the body led by Pat Turner, made up of a coalition of peaks. It means engaging with land councils. It means engaging with native title tribunals. It means engaging with First Nations people right around the country. There are different needs depending upon whether people are in urban communities like my electorate. The needs of people in Marrickville, that has a sizeable First Nations population, is very different from here of the Gumaj clan of the Yolngu people.
One of the architects of the Uluru Statement, Pat Anderson, says that you should be embarking on a Truth and Justice Commission. Are you saying it's not that? That's not what you're going to do?
Well, that's not what we have proposed. What we've proposed is Makarrata just being the idea of coming together.
So it's talking to land councils.
That's what we want to do.
Talking to,
well, engaging. Being here is a starting point. I think it's disappointing that the other political parties aren't here.
Well, indeed, Peter Dutton says that if he's in government, there will be no Makarrata, there will be no truth-telling. So if you are re-elected, when you say there will be Makarrata, you're talking about simply, as Prime Minister, engaging with different Indigenous groups.
Ongoing engagement is what we do, a coming together. Now, that might take forms as it evolves.
What does that mean?
What it means is I don't preempt it. Hmm. What it means is listening to and respecting First Nations people and then responding. We know that what we've been doing up to now, where more than half or more than two-thirds, tragically, of the Closing the Gap targets currently aren't on track to being met. So we can't just do things the same way. And part of that, of course, must involve listening to people who are directly affected.
What about acknowledging past wrongs, though? Here at Garma, the Northern Territory Police Commissioner has issued an apology for past injustices and hurt by the police service here. Is that the sort of thing that fits with what you're talking about as part of Makarrata?
Absolutely it does.
So you would encourage more of this?
That's a good thing. Of course. Who's against? I'm not quite sure how Peter Dutton justifies saying he's against truth-telling, telling the truth about history, or against people coming together in dialogue.
So would you encourage other police commissioners to do this?
One of the things, well, it's up to them, but in general, it's a good idea to acknowledge history and to acknowledge that why we are here today is because of that history. It's because of the incarceration rates, and you can't say that there's some inherent reason why that is the case, that there's some reason why First Nations people are more likely. Obviously, it is because of the circumstances of their birth, because of the economic conditions which are there, which is why in so many areas, one of the things that I want to do as well is to celebrate the successes. Hmm. We need to be optimistic if we're going to move forward. And here, the educational attainment that is happening here with Yolngu people, with higher retention rates, people going on to tertiary education. I met a young woman yesterday who's studying law at Melbourne University. We need to celebrate that.
I understand, and there is progress to celebrate, but too often, coming to the closing the gap issues, it is just not enough progress. The latest figures do show that only 5 of 19 targets are on track to be met. 4 areas are still going backwards, getting worse: suicide rates, incarceration, kids going into out-of-home care. Do you understand why that's happening?
Well, there has to be structural reasons why that's the case. You have intergenerational disadvantage. If you have people born into an existence which doesn't have a secure roof over their head, that doesn't have access to education, that has different health outcomes as well, the rates of so many diseases are so much higher in Indigenous communities, then that is because of structures which are there, which is why we sought to listen to the request from Indigenous Australians.
Now, so now what do you do?
We accept the outcome. Well, we continue to listen, not through a voice to Parliament. We accept the outcome, but we continue to work. We have, since that, announced the replacement of the CDP. That was essentially a work for the dole, a make work program. We've replaced that with the remote community and economic development program. So real jobs with real training.
But as you say,
real wages and conditions. So that's part of it. $4 billion into remote housing.
I'll come to that as well. The argument for the voice from you and your ministers was that it would deliver better practical outcomes. I mean, your health minister said it would reduce suicide rates, for example. Do you need some other type of body, advisory body, that can do what you were talking about, even if it's not in the Constitution?
Well, we're listening to the Coalition of Peaks, and we're engaging with organisations as well right around the country. We have a new Indigenous Affairs Minister, Malinderi McCarthy, who comes from this part of the world in Arnhem Land. We have continued to engage, and we will continue to listen. Has to be part of it.
But you don't need a new body.
Change can't be. Well, we accept the outcome of the referendum. So what we need to do is to work on ways which do make a practical difference. The voice was never the end in itself. The voice was the means to close the gap by listening to people. And the Uluru Statement from the Heart made that very clear.
And you're now saying you can do that with the existing bodies.
Well, we're saying we weren't successful.
So there you have it. I think a commitment to Makarrata and the intent or the spirit behind it, and the Uluru Statement, Malinderi McCarthy was also quite vocal in that area. She's the new Indigenous Affairs Minister because Linda Burney has moved on from that. Malinderi also spoke recently to ABC News Breakfast, I think it was. Let's take a quick listen.
Senator, why is the government ditching its promise to set up a Makarrata Commission?
Yes, I've been reading all the papers, Michael, and I have to say that when I was at Gulkula in Arnhem Land beside the Prime Minister, that's clearly not what I heard. He certainly gave very strong principal support for the Uluru Statement from the Heart. He's maintained that in terms of the voice, having taken the referendum to the people last year. And the values around Makarrata, treaty and truth-telling, are still very strong for our government.
OK, so we got it wrong. You are pressing ahead with a Makarrata Commission.
What I will say is that this was an opportunity. Can I just remind everyone, before you all get too carried away here, this was the first chance for the Prime Minister and for myself and for so many Australians to come together at Gama since the loss of the referendum. I said at the time that it was deeply traumatising for First Nations people who largely voted yes, especially in the northern parts of the country. We heard from the CEO, Denise Bowden, say it was soul-shattering, Michael. So this was a chance for everyone to come together. And I ask all Australians, and in particular the media and fellow parliamentarians, to remember that this was a sacred time in Gama. And it was really the first time that the Prime Minister had the opportunity to face the people directly. It took great courage to take the voice to the people of Australia. It took great courage to return to the people that he promised to take the referendum forward. And I would ask respectfully, especially on behalf of the Yolngu people, who appreciated deeply his presence there. And they know that this is an ongoing journey.
So there you go. Malandiri McCarthy, the latest in a line of Indigenous Affairs Minister. But Ginyara, really, it is a tough situation because the solution can't be found there. This is the reality of the whole situation.
Well, I'll correct you on one little thing first. Minister for Indigenous Affairs, that was a long time ago. That was six, 7 years ago. Indigenous Australians. Now, Indigenous Australians are all of them, in my opinion, the white fellas, the black fellas, the whole box and dice. They're all Indigenous Australians. This is the crazy part. You can't find the solution inside Australia. You know, when they talk about Makarrata, they're all kind of hinting at a treaty, aren't they? Well, you know, they're saying, well, the states are going to be responsible for treaties and states are not sovereign enough to do treaties. That's been proven in a number of court cases in Australia, that the states are like the old colonial colonies that were out here. They were never sovereign enough to enter into treaties, just as the Commonwealth of Australia wasn't in the very early days. That power remained within the United Kingdom or Great Britain. So the states, being Australian states, are not capable of treaty. But then they talk about Makarrata at the federal level. Well, are they talking to Yidinji, for example, you know, the real deal stuff, those who are in their correct capacity, those who are not Indigenous Australians?
Well, we know the answer to that. Obviously, we never get invited to these things, and it's very difficult to meet with these people in their official capacity because they just probably find us annoying and right. I think it's extremely important to let people know that.
Well, I'll just say last year we were told in no uncertain terms we are right down in Canberra. It was said to us by a number of experts, use a right.
Hmm. So that means the Yidinji Nation is moving forward. It's taking care of its business, and we'll talk a little bit about that later in the program. But coming back to what Malandiri McCarthy was saying in that interview there, Ginyara, she said a promised Makarrata Commission has not been abandoned, because that was the fear of the Indigenous Australians that you said you're going to do treaty and voice and Makarrata and all that kind of stuff. The Prime Minister appeared to have ditched the Makarrata in that original interview with David Spears there. So now Malandiri is saying that they're going to be talking to other Indigenous Australians, probably the coalition of the peak organisations, in principle about the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Once again, it has failed. It has failed. And it will fail again. No doubt. There'll be a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. There'll be a lot of promises of this and that. But ultimately, the Commonwealth of Australia is in a bind. It's stuck. And the only way is, from what we can see, is the Yidinji way, the tribes that need to create that mechanism.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Where are the other mechanisms? That's the question I ask you. You know, we have to do a treaty somehow with someone. It has to be done. But how are we going to do it if we're all Indigenous Australians? It can't be done. How can that secure the future of Australia? It can't. It's got to be done in its true capacity. And look, Yidinji has gone out for the last 10 years to do this. It's a long, hard slog. This is no easy road to hoe, I tell you now. And one thing I will say, in light of what's going on around the world, we are doing this without any hint, and I'll say this categorically, there is no hint of any violence coming from the Yidinji side, because we are right. We are right, but we don't need to go out and prove we're right with a big stick. This is something that all the Aboriginal people must understand around Australia, that if you are right, you have right on your side. Eventually you will get there. It's a long, hard slog, but we are right. The world is going crazy at present. And Yidinji are offering the solution to Australia for not one Australian dollar, and we don't need to be violent in any way, shape or form.
No, that's that's very much the same song we've been singing from the very beginning is doing it in the interests of universal peace and perpetual amity. This is what the Yidinji Nation wants. This is why the Yidinji Nation is forging relationships with other tribal nations and encouraging them to set up their self-governance models in accord with their traditions and customs. And that's coming along very well. In fact, later this month we will hold the Intertribal Foreign Affairs Council Forum here in the city of Gimoy. And already I think we have about nearly 70 people that are attending that from as far as down south, if you want to use Australian descriptions, Victoria, over in WA and many others that are sending their delegations, their foreign ministers, some of the other ministers from those nations are coming up. And this is history in the making. Not only that, the College of Law, the ANU, the political scientist Matt Kvartrup, who's been on this program before, are also speaking at it. Why would they be speaking at something like this or attending something like this and participating? Is because there's something new happening, and it is the paradigm that is peaking its head around the world.
You mean we're right? That was said to us last year. Why weren't we at GAMA? That's for Indigenous Australians. Sorry to say, you know, all those people that went and attended that, they have another capacity to go in, but they all attended as Indigenous Australians. And that's why I had to correct the statement for Indigenous Affairs. No, it's the Minister for Indigenous Australians, and that came about. I think Nigel Scullion was the last Minister for Indigenous Affairs, if I can remember right, and then it's been Indigenous Australians ever since. So I sort of, you know, I know what you can see what's going on around the place. They're sort of pussyfooting around the backlash they got from The Voice, you know, like as in a lot of people said no, you can't blame the government for being a bit hesitant now to talk about Makarrata, because the majority of people are not of the 3% Indigenous heritage, I suppose, the blood background. So the rest, the 97%, have got a lot to say, and they are saying it, and it's bringing about the far right movement, which is what I'm saying. We're doing this for everyone. We don't want to encourage any sort of violence on any way, shape or form on this country. Look, everyone, all humans deserve the right, the ability to go about their life freely without any threat or harm or injury. And that's the Yidinji way. You know, if it takes us a bit longer, so be it. You know, we're going to do it the right way. We have to do it the right way. And my biggest issue would be if we caused harm to another human being, I'd be very concerned about that. So we don't want any harm to any human being, the far right, the far left, the centre, it doesn't matter. We're all on this little planet together, so we've got to learn to look after each other, and there's enough violence going on now. So, you know, the GAMA festival is well and good where they can get together. But I noticed there were some people weren't there. There were some of the elders, they refused to go to that. Fair enough. I agree that that's not the answer to them. It's just another talk fest, in my opinion. Nothing comes of it. They're talking about telling the truth now, you know, the truth-telling commission. The states are talking about that, yet in Queensland, the police refused to take part in the truth-telling commission. You know, how is this going to work? Australians, all Australians need to know the truth of what the state of play really is here. And do they have a treaty? Is their tenure secure on this country?
Well, the other thing that you mentioned there with the police, and one of the things that did happen at the weekend was the Northern Territory Police Commissioner apologised. And that was, you know, it seems very, very genuine, and he got painted up and things like that. But when you look at what he said, I think his name's Michael Murphy. He's apologised to Indigenous Territorians for injustices carried out by police over the past 154 years. So, once again, it's not an apology to the Gumatj tribe and to the other tribal nations, because it's to the Territorians. So we committed these things to the mob that carry our identities. Yep. And that is the Indigenous Australian. That is the Indigenous Territorian. That is the Indigenous Queenslander. That is the Indigenous Western Australian. That is the Indigenous Tasmanian.
And I'll say one thing I'll notice that he didn't say unlike the Victorian police force, who recognised that the sovereignty of the Indigenous nations there is unceded, I see he didn't make that statement, you know, that we're going to talk about the nations who haven't ceded their authority, their sovereignty. So they're being very careful about what's said there. And that was said last year at the Euro Commission in Victoria, that at the head of the start there, and I think Tony McAvoy was the one that asked the question, do you recognise the sovereignty of the Indigenous nations there? And he said, yes, we do. We recognise their sovereignty is still there, but not over there, you know. So same in Queensland. They're not recognising the sovereignty yet, but they'll get around to it. They'll get there.
Well, I mean, it's in their best interest, I think. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the juvenile detention rates in the Northern Territory is like a year from now, or how many children are being taken away from their families, because as history has shown us before, apology 2008 or thereabouts, whenever that was, yes, that's they said sorry, that was fantastic, but guess what? It's worse now than it was before. So this is despite the truth-telling in the bringing them home report. So what more evidence do you need?
So what's changed?
Exactly. And the other thing that's changing is the landscape here is that the law is being revitalised. The government is getting back into a modern space to assist the Yidinji Nation to move forward in international waters and on home soil. And that's an amazing thing. You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to the Yidinji Broadcast Service and our friends at Bumma Bitra Media, 98.7 FM. We'll be back after the break.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I just had me a good year and I doubled up on my funds. Got a gold plaque on my wall now, said I take it all as it comes. I just put a ring on my girl now, cause I've been knowing she the one. And we just had us a son, new times have only begun. I told you all we ain't done. Built a studio in my hometown, black fellas with a new sound. If you didn't know, well you know now. Only real shit in my DNA, Gomer Roy, I ain't come to play. Bid you good with my people stay from the 35 after lop away. I was an underdog in my city, odds stacked up, I had to get gritty. Flip two packs or so, it's no biggie. Still all gratitude, it's no pity. Too much work to do to get litty. Hustle hard to stay smart like Fitty. Can't stop and won't stop, no ditty. They tryna fake the way, I'm like, really? We work hard to get to this spot. All this blood and sweat that I've dropped, all these eyes on me that stay watch. That's for my daughter and them, I stay locked. I used to dream of shit that I've got. No matter what goals I kick, I won't stop. I work hard in places they not. The times that I've dropped, I pick myself up to get to the top. One time for my day ones, two time for the fake ones. Who gon' hate on but won't say none, huh? Three time for them go-getters, take a flight with no propellers. My warriors and my storytellers, huh? I said one time for them day ones, two time for the fake ones. Who gon' hate on but won't say none, huh? Three time for them go-getters, take flight with no propellers. My warriors and my storytellers, huh?
Yes, well, earlier I spoke about, welcome back to the show, by the way, Black Law Tribal Edition. Earlier I spoke about Professor Matt Quartrip, who is a political scientist from the University of Coventry. He's also doing some time with the ANU at the moment. Very, very esteemed gentleman, wrote a number of books on how to run your own country or start your own country, for example, which we have a few copies lying around in the office, by the way. He also wrote a book on Angela Merkel that was translated into Russian, Chinese and a few other languages, so he knows his stuff. And earlier, this is a recording done last year, I spoke with him about his book and why he's interested in the Yidinji way. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's wonderful to be here. It's a great honour and a great pleasure.
I guess let's start with a simple one. Why did you just write this book, and how did you get interested in the topic of jurisdiction and new states being formed, etc.?
Yes, well, it's a bit of a long story, as everything else, especially at my age. There's been quite a few stories around. So it goes back to when I was a graduate student. I was asked to advise on possible independence movements in Mindanao, in the Philippines. But more recently, I, and basically that started me off going to all sorts of places from South Sudan to Scotland where people wanted to break free, as it were, in the title. And I've been involved in that. Most recently, I was in Bougainville, currently part of PNG. I came there before they had a referendum a few years ago, helped them to establish the rules that they could use in the referendum, and then also back after the vote had taken place. They asked me to write a report about it becoming an independent country, which sort of summed up what I had been doing for many years, really. Manchester University Press, which has published many of my other books, said, well, why don't you write a book about it? And I said, well, I've got a report, and I sent it in. And the guy, Tom Dark, who was the then editor there, says, but we want a bit more sort of like, can you do as a DIY guide to if you want to establish your own country, complete with Gantt charts and all of that? So basically, sort of, you know, picking it up, you need to know what to do. So it was based on that report there. And then I thought, while I was at it, I might as well but also tell a little bit of the story of how I got into that. So the book has elements of my experiences. I think it's always a good idea when you're writing a book on a serious subject, such as creating an independent state, that the person who is writing about it has some, well, street cred, we would say, in East London. So I use examples from where I have been involved and then basically provide a step-by-step guide to it, but in a way which is hopefully not sort of too academic-y, too much focused on the law. That's all of that is there, but, you know, it's bite-sized and easily digestible.
Yes, I know it's not a book for dummies, let's say. I know there's a whole franchise around that, but this is just looking at the structure of it. It is quite refreshing to see, let's say, layman's terms, or someone who can read it, who maybe not scientifically astute or academically trained, for example, like myself, but it is something that a lot of people, especially on this continent, indigenous populations are looking at these matters seriously, and not everyone has a law degree. So I think there is a step-by-step, really good guide track there. I'm just wondering, what has helped you do that? I know you mentioned Bougainville, but something as a child, you would have been growing up and living in multiple jurisdictions in your life and working things out as you go. Did that influence your writing at all? I know that you've got personal experiences in the book here.
I must have been about 10 at the time when there started to be an independence movement in Quebec. I lived in Canada as a child. And I remember I had to do a history essay, and then I wrote a history essay about how the French should be allowed to have a referendum on independence. Mr. Vanplu, who was a teacher, contacted my parents and was very concerned about these views that the French should be allowed to have a referendum, from the 10-year-old me. And I remember people were sort of so I was sort of fighting for that. Not that I'm not French speaking Canadian. But I was interested in that, and I think that sort of started me off. Then later, when I studied law, I was interested in international law. That's how I got into it. And by the time that I had then, you know, had a few experiences in the practical world, I went back to looking at this issue and did my doctorate on the subject. At that stage, it was suggested it was a good idea to talk about, because it was it wasn't sort of like an issue that was sort of was timely. And then no sooner had I started my doctorate than the Soviet Union collapsed and lots of little countries were established, and of course there was another vote in Quebec. So it's been sort of like a professional thing that has been spurred on by my personal interests during my life, and also having lived in different jurisdictions, I suppose you get an appreciation of how people are different and you know, can thrive and flourish when they're in their own you know, cultural habitat, if you like. Or the Germans have this wonderful word, it's a Heimat, a place where you feel at home. And sometimes you can only feel at home in a place if you're in control over that. So so I think there's an emotional element to all of this, but I try in the book to be fair-minded about it. I've chosen to become an academic and a lawyer because I'm advising people. I say how it can be done. So recently I was in Scotland and people say, well, why do you get involved in our fight? I said, I don't get involved in your fight. I'm just telling you how, if that is your fight, how you can be successful and how you typically will be successful. And there's a number of steps you have to go through. You need to establish a story. There's an old saying from sort of Greek drama that a drama stands and falls with the plot. And every independence movement is an opera, it's a drama, and you need to have that credible story to start with. And once you've established that, it's no accident, by the way, that one of the leaders of the Italian movement that led to a Risorgimento when Italy became a state in the 19th century was Verdi, the composer. We think about Verdi as just opera, but Verdi was an Italian patriot. The Italian independence movement was spearheaded by Victor Emmanuel, who was the king of Sardinia at the time. And the slogan, he was the one who basically sort of spearheaded the unification of Italy. And people would write on the walls V-E-R-D-I, and people thought that's just graffiti for an opera man. But actually, Verdi means Victor Emmanuel, Re d'Italia, so Victor Emmanuel, King of Italy. So the slogan there was a political slogan. And if, you know, you go through the operas, then Aida, for example, is about it has a nationalist theme, and some of the La Pensiera, which is this sort of big chorus song. Normally operas, of course, have symphonic, so sorry if I get into the music part of this, but that's sort of like different sort of harmonies, but this one is sung in unison, and I think that is, to come back to the point, that's, you know, the you need to find a way of singing in unison, not necessarily, you can do it in harmony, but it has to have that, create that sort of movement. It's very interesting, actually. I mean, I'm not I don't have a great knowledge about classical music, but if we think of some of the greatest pieces of music, classical music in the 19th century, then most of that were actually propaganda songs. So Peer Gynt in Norway is by Grieg, who was a great patriot for Norwegian independence, Verdi in Italy, and Sibelius in Finland. So, you know, some of the greatest, composers created that. And it is about creating this movement, creating the story about we have a right to break free. Then once you've established that, then there's the legal aspects, the political aspects, and the economic aspects, and then off you go.
Yes, it's something that I saw you on an interview online about, and I've always wondered about the Scottish situation, because for us it makes sense that Scotland, England, Wales, they're all different jurisdictions. So why isn't Scotland independent? Is it a lack of a people's movement, or that unison that you're talking about by its leadership? Or where do you see it sort of missing the mark, or the potential to actually push it over the edge?
I think it was originally, of course, Scotland originally was a country, and then they more or less went bankrupt, and then to be bailed out, they signed up with the English. That's sort of the very plotted history of Scotland's non-independence. I think the problem that the Scottish government currently, by the Scottish National Party, some people refer to them as Scottish Nationalist Party, which is wrong. It's not IST, it's Scottish National Party. And the thing with the Scottish National Party is that they are basically social democrats. They are more Nordic than they are European, and certainly more Nordic in the sort of, they're more like the Norwegians and the Swedes than they are like the English or the Spaniards, for that matter. But it's very much a rational movement. when there was a Scottish referendum on independence, they published an 800-page report about how Scotland could be viable as economically as an independent country, which is, you know, admirable in a way, if you want to go into detail about that. But what you really need when you create a movement is a story. And the story is just not written in econometric statistics, because that doesn't quite fire you up. There was a Scottish philosopher, David Hume, who says that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions. It doesn't mean that we don't use reason, but reason is what we use to make our dreams come true. But the dreams can't be rationalized. Dreams are fundamental. Think with the heart rather than the mind. And the problem for the Scottish independence movement at the moment is that they're doing that again. I've spoken about classical music before, now I'll have a pop reference, and I have referred to this as the Britney Spears moment. Oops, they did it again. So they're doing this all over. And if Scotland is to become an independent country, which, you know, it's again, that's not my fight. It depends on what the Scottish people would want. Then they need to do that, you know, sort of, it's been hearts rather than minds. I'm a British citizen. I live in the UK. And I was not enormously enthusiastic about Brexit, to put it mildly. I'm personally the personification of the European Union. But I admire the people who campaigned, because they made it a campaign for independence, effectively. They had slogans that you really couldn't argue with, like take back control or I want my country back. Now, when I interviewed one of the political consultants who was behind them, he says that is a thing that is literally priceless. Nobody can ever argue against getting back control or taking a country back. People can all argue with an economic statistics that says you're going to have a GDP that's 4% lower if you leave. Then people say, oh, well, whatever, really, that's going to, you know. And those are the economic arguments. But it's, you know, people are willing to take a hit, you know. Some people, but people are not willing to say, well, I want to be enslaved and I don't want to have control over myself. So that wasn't an economic argument. All the economic arguments were that Brexit wouldn't work, and it's probably been borne out by the predicament that my country is currently in. However, things go up and down, and you might come back to that. But so the important thing really is the story, to create that story, and then, of course, not just appeal to your own people, also appeal to having friends in higher places, but that's a little bit later in the storyline of this book.
Yes, you're listening to Blacklaw Tribal Edition right across the multiverses today. My guest is Professor Matt Quartrup, the author of I Want to Break Free, A Practical Guide to Making a New Country. The book is available through Manchester University Press, and he's given us his time today, which is wonderful, because Professor, there is a legal side. You've explained a little bit about that. You need that momentum. You need the public interest, and you need that moment where people do feel like they want to break free from something.
Yes.
But there is moment where you look at something where people are fighting from the inside of something that's already been created, mm-hmm. as opposed to maybe creating something that's outside. And I'm just wondering, is that similar to the Catalonian situation, in that the Spanish Parliament created their Parliament and that they wanted to break free, but Spain may have something to say against that or with that, and that's a lengthy process.
Yes.
Where Catalonians may want it, but Spain and its various interest groups may not want that.
No, and I think obviously all these cases are quite complex, and the reason why the Madrid government, or the Castilian government, if you want it, was opposed to it was that they were embroiled in a corruption scandal, and they tried to find a fight that would deter, that it was sort of like detract There will make few people not focus on Madrid, and the government in Catalonia was in the same position. They also wanted to focus on something else. So there were matters that were of more political nature, and probably one of the reasons why it hasn't sort of taken off completely. I was in Barcelona at the time of the vote. And of course, if you'd seen pictures on TV, there would be like running battles and so on. But that was in two streets. And the taxi driver, when I asked him about it, you know, and any traveling journalist, as you will remember from or know, is you always ask the taxi driver, and they will be the first one. And he was sort of very non-committal, but was more interested in how many goals Messi had scored for the Barcelona football team. And I was most disappointed at that. But the Castilian case is one where there is a history, but it hasn't quite been able to be sort of reformulated. And it's often been around the football team, Barcelona, CF Barcelona. However, that is a team that is only strong because it plays in the Spanish league. So then that leads to all sorts of other questions. But in Catalonia, I think they do have a cultural uniqueness about them. But I think that your question now is moving on to sort of the legal story of it. And the legal story, which is, I suppose, my area of expertise, as it were, is divided into two. And in the problem with that is that there is domestic law and then there's international law, and in a way, never the twain shall meet. So if we're dealing with domestic law, then a country has a right to become independent or hold an independence vote when basically three conditions are met, or put forward, depending how you skin this particular cat. First of all, if you've been a former colony, and Eritrea or one of the African countries, then by virtue of that, you have a right to independence. There is this a General Assembly Resolution 1514 from 1960 that says basically all these countries that were colonies, they have a right to become independent. Then the second possibility is if you live in a country where there is explicit right to self government or secession. The Soviet Union used to have that. It was just never used because it had to be sanctioned by Moscow, and they never allowed it. But many of the countries that did become independent, like Ukraine, actually used that particular section in the Soviet Constitution when Montenegro became an independent country in 2006. They used that in the Serbian-Montenegro constitution, the right for independence. And then the third option is that if you are living in a country that is not a democracy, where you can't enforce your democratic rights, then your only recourse is to have a unilateral referendum. So if you're looking at the case of Catalonia, then Catalonia was not a colony. Technically, they entered it because it was originally a marriage of a prince and a princess, and then they got together. That was the fashion at the time. So Catalonia it was not a colony. It's not a place where it's in the Spanish constitution. And Spain, while the government was probably quite heavy-handed, is for all intents and purposes, a fairly democratic place. So that's sort of in domestic law, which. And we can kind of come back to the politics of it later. Now, domestic law will always be, by its nature, I suppose, conservative law. I mean, the law, if you want to be philosophical about it, is always looking back. It's the laws of the past, and then as time goes on, they become more and more obsolete. But there is also international law, and international law in this regard is probably more interesting because international law is based... there are different sort of theories of recognition, and there's a thing called the declaratory theory and the constituent theory. And now I sound like a law professor, which is what I am in real life, and I'll try to explain it. So the original thing was this constituent part, where basically you say, well, in other countries have to recognise you before you're a state. And that's a little bit old hat now. That was probably true in the 19th and the early 20th century. Since the middle part, probably in the 1930s, a new thing became the basic principle in international law, and that's normally known as the Estrada Doctrine. He was the Mexican foreign minister. I always like the story about Estrada. It's got a wonderful sort of Spanish sound to it. And he was a Mexican foreign minister and said to the Americans, look, you tend to recognize countries you like, but sometimes they're actually countries you don't like who actually perform various functions. So why don't you become a little bit more pragmatic about it? And Estrada was, I suppose, by persuasion alone, able to convince the Americans that they should accept this alternative version. There's also a thing called the Montevideo Convention, as just I think you've mentioned to me before. Listeners will not know that we have spoken before here. And that basically has a three-pronged approach. You have to have a defined territory, a defined population, and then you have to perform the functions of a state. So you have to issue driver's licenses, for example, collect fines, make sure that child support is being paid, you know, those sort of mundane kind of boring issues. And if you tick those three boxes, you are a state. Lord Denning, who was a very famous English judge who had a good sort of turn of phrase, was defined this in one of his judgments in international law. He says, basically, if you're able to sue that country, if for all practical purposes is running the show, then it is a state. So there have been a number of countries which, under domestic law, would not have qualified as states. People may know Iceland as a country. You might think that Iceland's been around forever. Well, Iceland has kind of been around forever. However, in legal international terms, Iceland became independent of Denmark in 1944. The Danes at the time, occupied by the Germans, said, well, you can't do that. And the Icelandics probably gave a sort of middle finger kind of approach to them, said, well, just watch us. And of course, the Danes weren't in a position to do that, and the Icelandics declared independence. There was a defined territory, a defined population, and they had been, throughout the Second World War, was able to do all the practical things that you do when you're a state, and therefore were, you know, was also recognised as a state. But this recognition bit is not the main be all and end all. It's quite sort of symbolic. The Chinese will talk about Taiwan not being recognised, and they will, you know, give money to places where they don't recognise it. And the Russians want the people to recognise the independent state of Abkhazia, which is the part of Georgia that's occupied by Russia. And all of these things, but that's more for show, really. So those are sort of the legal terms. So it's defined territory, defined population, and performing the functions of a state. And of course, to be able to do that, you need friends in high places.
And that brings an end to the show for this week. Ganyara, some final comments before we head off.
Yeah, look, the best thing I can say to everyone is, look, understand. What this Indigenous Australian stuff means. Understand that there is no solution inside Australia. Understand that we've got to come back in our true and correct capacity and by the way, in friendship with the Australians. Where do the Australians go? Because I saw a comment was raised in Tasmania in their sit-in, you know, down there. There's a political sit-in down in Tasmania at present by the Aboriginal people. And one white fellow got up and said, well, aren't we all Australians? Where do we go? We don't have a homeland. Unlike the anyone else, for example, you know, the Japanese have a homeland, the English have a homeland. Where do the white Australians go?
Well, the English do have a homeland. I think they're being tested at the moment. And, you know, to be fair, I've spoken to our ambassador over there and just got a background briefing on that all because he is living, obviously, near those areas that are being tested at the moment. But on a serious note, you know, you're going to see that friction and tension all over the globe, because it is manifesting, and the ones that have the solution are the tribes. There's no other way around it.
Well, that friction and tension is not welcome on our country.
100%.
All humans, black, white, brindle, Australian, Japanese, it doesn't matter. We don't want to see that friction here. And that's something that I've got to keep stating to all the people that I talk to. We don't want that here. This is a peaceful part of the world. We always were peaceful. It's the civilised world that have become a bit unpeaceful. So just take notice of what's going on. We're here to offer the solution, and for not one Australian dollar. We don't want to do that. We've got to do this properly for each other.
Yeah, I think in recent times it's been very fairly peaceful. Obviously, the first few years of British contact here wasn't, but in terms of a modern period, there has been a bit of argy-bargy, obviously. A